It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. If you've gone grocery shopping recently, you've probably noticed more and more gluten-free foods. General Mills alone offers more than 300 gluten-free items, and restaurants are featuring a number of gluten-free options. Even PNC Park has a concession stand serving gluten-free hot dogs and beer. But while there is more and more consumer demand for these products, especially among people who have celiac disease, they may not be the healthy alternative you envision. Today, we're looking at the explosion of gluten-free products and whether it's a healthy choice for everyone. I'm joined in Studio A by Dr. Kofi Clark, a gastroenterologist and director of the Celiac Center at Allegheny General Hospital. Dr. Clark, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Thank you for having me.
Also with us in studio is Amy Macklin, a registered dietitian, nutritionist, and owner of Gluten-Free Foods, a Robinson-based consulting business. Amy Macklin, good to have you with us.
Thank you for having me. My company's Roots, Gluten-Free Roots.
Gluten-Free Roots. What did I say?
Foods.
I said foods. No, yes. I even had it right in front of me. Gluten-Free Roots, a Robinson-based consulting business. Glad we were able to straighten that out. Amy, good to have you with us. And you can join the conversation by calling 412-246-2002. That's 412-246-2002. You can email us at essspgh@wesa.fm and reach us on Twitter at essspgh and follow the conversation at #EPLive. We'd like to hear from you if you have celiac disease, and even if you don't, have gluten-free products helped you? 412-246-2002, the number to call. Dr. Clark, I'd like to begin by having you explain what celiac disease is.
Okay, thank you. Once again, thanks for having me here this afternoon. Celiac disease, specifically, it's an enteropathy caused by people who eat gluten-containing foods or products, and they develop certain bowel symptoms and other symptoms that may not be directly related to the bowel. They are characteristic tests that we do from blood tests and also biopsies that we take in the bowel when we do endoscopies, which have features that make a diagnosis of celiac disease. So typically, the simplest explanation is it's a bowel enteropathy with a lot of other systemic features precipitated by people who are predisposed and eat a gluten-free diet.
Is there a cure for celiac disease?
So cure in the sense of cure as we understand it, perhaps not, but we can control it by maintaining a lifelong gluten-free diet. There are a few research projects going out there about medicines you can take which might prevent your symptoms. But in terms of getting your disease controlled, what we know now is a lifelong gluten-free diet.
And what are the medicines someone would take?
So let me stress again, these are purely experimental. There's one company out in California which has done some initial work and made a product which is a proprietary product, and it's not marketable yet, so I'm not going to mention that, which suggests that if you take a pill of that in the research study that they published, your symptoms when you get exposed to gluten-containing foods, if you have celiac, may be slightly reduced. Please keep in mind, this is only experimental. It's not for public consumption yet.
How common is celiac disease?
So by what we defined and based on research studies, perhaps one in every 130 Americans, and the other end of the spectrum is between one in 130 or between one in 140 Americans by blood test would have celiac disease. So that is what they did was they looked at a series of blood samples collected, and if you test those randomly, so it's a little over one in 100 people who test positive for celiac.
Is it more prevalent in other parts of the world? Do we see more cases of it on other continents?
So that's a very good thought. We used to think several years ago that it was perhaps less common here in the United States than it was in other parts of the world, particularly Europe and specifically Ireland. What we see now is that perhaps what the numbers we see in the U.S. are very similar to what we see in other parts of the world.
And why do we know so little about it? If one in 130 people in the United States have this, it still seems to be somewhat of a mystery in many ways.
So yes and no. I think we've always known about it, but it's attracted much more public attention lately for several reasons. So there's more publicity given to it, and people are much more aware of the disease. So let's stress again, one in 130 may have positive blood tests for celiac. The large majority of them may not have any symptoms at all.
412-246-2002. Amy, I promise we will get to some questions for you, but let's welcome in a caller, Jerry from Pittsburgh, who has an important distinction to make. Jerry, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Thank you.
Go ahead with your comment or question.
Yeah, okay. So there is another entity which is called adult onset gluten intolerance, which is not celiac disease, which seems to develop in some adults over time and did develop in me. I was having terrible GI discomfort and I couldn't figure out why. And I went online and I learned about the possibility of adult onset gluten intolerance. And I just took gluten out of my diet for 2 weeks, felt a million times better, and then re-challenged myself with gluten, immediately felt worse, and then went off of it again, and I immediately felt better. So there is, not everyone has an immune disease that's the basis of celiac, but there is something called adult onset gluten intolerance, and I think it's important for the public to know that, but not go crazy over it, because it's now becoming a fad diet to be gluten-free, and I don't know that there is any health benefit in doing that.
Well, Jerry, we'll get into some of that, but Dr. Clark, what about the distinction Jerry is making? He says it's important to note the difference between celiac disease and gluten intolerance.
Yes, Jerry. So we've known about this for a while now. And specifically, if you want to be a little more specific, we categorize those groups of people into an entity which we describe as non-celiac gluten intolerance or non-celiac gluten sensitivity. Other people have even broadened it and called it non-celiac wheat intolerance. And it encompasses people who don't tolerate gluten-based foods or products like you describe, and also certain groups of people who may react to wheat-based foods, which does not necessarily relate to gluten itself. It is important, though, to keep in mind that even though we've recognized this entity for a while, it is not very well defined. And as you rightly said, it is a distinct phenomenon from celiac. But before people get labeled with celiac disease, then they fit into the category of what we spoke about earlier on.
Amy Macklin, how much do we really know about gluten intolerance? Do we fully understand it?
I think that's more of a question for the doctor. But both of us were just recently in the Chicago in September. They had the International Celiac Disease Symposium where all the celiac researchers and experts from around the world meet. And this is more of a question for the doctor, but my takeaway from this is they definitely believe there's to be more research because they do believe there are people that have gluten sensitivity, but science hasn't clearly defined those markers yet.
I understand that you have a child that has celiac disease,
he does have celiac disease.
How do you keep your child on a gluten-free diet, even at school?
He packs his lunch. And he was diagnosed at 3, now he's 14. So we are 10 and a half years into what I call the lifestyle, because to me, it's more than a diet. It truly is a lifestyle change. So to him, it's second nature. And in elementary school, and schools are willing to adapt to your child's diet. So they will make arrangements and provide gluten-free foods for your child. But at this time, my son chooses to pack his lunch.
412-246-2002, if you'd like to join the conversation. We're talking with Dr. Kofi Clark, a gastroenterologist and director of the Celiac Center at Allegheny General Hospital, and also Amy Macklin, a registered dietitian, nutritionist, and owner of Gluten-Free Roots, a Robinson-based consulting business. Let's go to the phones. We have Susan from Churchill on the line. Susan, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Thank you. I wanted to ask a question about intolerance. Well, I've been tested, and I'm allergic to barley, among a lot of other things. And it's not celiac disease, but I still have to avoid barley, which has gluten in it. And my allergist is a research scientist, and he's very well thought of, but he has no idea what to look for on labels. And I have a suspicion that malt, molasses, and maybe a lot of other things have barley either in them or they're processed with barley. It, you know, I get sick after eating certain things. Do you know what I should be looking for on food labels?
Well, that sounds like – go ahead, Amy.
Yes, I'll take that one. If I'm hearing you correctly, you're saying malt?
Is there a connection with malt and barley?
Malt. I didn't know if you're saying malt or malt.
No, it's malt, M-A-L-T.
Malt.
Yes, malt.
Barley, which are both ingredients in beer.
Barley is – malt is a form of barley. So that you would need to avoid on your diet if you're avoiding barley in your diet. So malt flavoring, malt extract. A lot of the food manufacturers are starting to put barley malt on the label. But if you just see malt, you could probably safely assume that it's barley malt because barley makes a great malt product. So that's what the manufacturers use.
So,
I suspected that. Are there other things that I should look for on labels?
No, just the malt flavoring, malt extract. Soups in that, if the barley pearl or the grains in there, mm-hmm. any malt or barley flour, things like that. But it would have barley with it, but your missing key is probably the malt.
Okay, thank you very much.
You're quite welcome.
Thank you for the call, Susan. So anybody who is allergic to barley should not only just avoid barley, but avoid malt and similar products. I'm curious as to whether people can develop celiac disease later in life, the same way people sometimes become allergic to foods they weren't allergic to before as they age.
So the answer is probably yes. And the reason why we say that is there are people who've had earlier screening tests for celiac which were negative, and as they grow older, you do the test for the blood work and you notice they develop the positive blood test, and subsequently you do the endoscopy with biopsies. So why do we say probably? There is also a section of people with true celiac disease that have no symptoms and they never get tested. So it's difficult to say that if you test someone at the age of 20, 30, or 40 and they have celiac disease, particularly if they have no symptoms, is it really a true new onset or they've actually had celiac for a while and never had symptoms? So that's why we say probably yes, people can develop that over time. One final comment on that. We do tell parents to get children screened and family members screened. And we say to them that if the initial screen is negative, then I think it's advisable to repeat it again in about 3 to 5 years, with the same thought in mind that people may eventually develop the condition if they are genetically predisposed to it. Yes.
So it shows up in a blood test.
Yes.
And you may have it even if you don't have any symptoms.
Yes.
So you're saying get tested every 3 to 5 years.
For those who are at high risk, not the general population.
And how do you know if you're at high risk?
So if you have a family member who has true celiac disease, if you have a parent or several members of your family having celiac disease, then you can do that. Or if you have certain conditions that cannot be simply explained, like several of the associated autoimmune conditions, unexplained anemias, which we can get into a little later on.
Let's go back to the phones. We have Eddie from downtown Pittsburgh joining us. Eddie, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Thank you very much. I do not have celiac disease. I'm actually a very healthy 55-year-old and very active. I swim every night. But my question is this. My next-door neighbor who had arthritis in his joints, of which I've had a problem with, and it's gotten greater over the past 5 years, being in both my wrists, which I use on a regular basis with my job, my neck and my knees. And he suggested to me to cut out as much gluten, if not all my gluten, for 25 days, because he said that there are types of glutens that act as inflammatories on your system, both with your immune system and with joints. And I don't know the truth to this. This is why I'm calling in to ask this question. I have followed it to the letter of the law over the last 25 days, maybe because of the coldness in Pittsburgh, the dampness, and the bad winter weather. I have noticed no decrease in my joint pain. However, 27 days ago, I weighed 163 pounds, and last night at the gym, after swimming, I weighed 151.
Hmm.
Well, so I'm going down.
One thing we know, let me jump in, Eddie, is that people with celiac disease can experience symptoms in all body systems, from joint pain and osteoporosis to mental
symptoms.
Effects like depression, foggy thinking, that kind of thing. So to Eddie's question, Dr. Clark, what about what he is saying, and is there any correlation there?
So Eddie makes a very interesting observation. You notice he hasn't had any improvement in his joint symptoms at all. And it goes back to what you just said. There are several conditions which are related to or associated with celiac disease, not necessarily a cause and effect. So there are certain joint conditions or joint symptoms that may be related to celiac disease, and people report different levels of improvement in symptoms. I need to stress, though, that a large number of people have the same kind of results that Eddie is talking about. And one of the reasons why we are keen to get out into the public domain is to let them know that when you have symptoms and they are not going away, please don't assume that going on a gluten-free diet is the solution. Get screened properly or talk to your doctor. There may be other things that you may be masking as well. And I think Amy might have a comment on that as well.
Yeah, I always recommend that people follow up with doctors when their symptoms, and the right doctor. You want to go to the right doctor when you have symptoms that are not clearing up.
We are talking with Dr. Kofi Clark and Amy Macklin on the subject of celiac disease and gluten-free foods, which we're seeing more of, more people interested in gluten-free diets. They don't always work or make you healthier. We'll explain more about that and take more of your calls as Essential Pittsburgh continues. You're listening to 90.5 WESA. It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. Our topic for this first part of the program is celiac disease and the proliferation of gluten-free foods. We're seeing more of them in stores and restaurants available to people who are gravitating toward a gluten-free diet. Is that always a good idea? What are the positive effects of a gluten-free diet? We're talking about that with Amy Macklin, a registered dietitian, nutritionist, and owner of Gluten-Free Roots, a Robinson-based consulting business. Also, Dr. Kofi Clark, a gastroenterologist and director of the Celiac Center at Allegheny General Hospital. If you'd like to join the conversation, 412-246-2002, the number to call again, 412-246-2002. Our email address, esspgh@wesa.fm. And you can reach us on Twitter at esspgh and follow the conversation at #EPLive. Let's take a call from Elizabeth in Forest Hills. Elizabeth, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Oh, hi there. Thanks for taking the call.
Yes.
Greetings to the folks you have on today, and thanks for doing the topic. My personal sense is that the growing sensitivity to gluten and other never-before-seen things that were cropping up, that we see cropping up in the health or lack thereof in the population, points to, in my feeling, an increasing denaturedness in our food supply, and that the gut is ultimately, generation after generation recently, reacting to that. So that, you know, gluten-free, those who are gluten-sensitive and gluten-intolerant are, in fact, one manifestation of, they're basically the canaries in the coal mine, pointing to the fact that we have very denatured wheat. We have our soils are being completely destroyed by the kinds of farming, industrial farming. And as a result, then you have generation after generation of folks who are showing up with sensitivities.
All right, Elizabeth, let me jump in. So she's asking whether modern farming methods, chemical additives, that type of thing, whether the way we are harvesting food today is contributing to celiac disease. That was, in fact, your question, Elizabeth?
It's not even so much a question. It's my absolute belief that if you have lousy soil and you have terrible farming methods and you have generations of people who are eating denatured food, you cannot but have those who are more sensitive. You're going to have strong genetics who are going to be able to plow through that.
Well, okay, we've got your point. So what about what she's saying? Do you believe, Dr. Clark, that there's some truth to what to the point that Elizabeth is making?
So several people have made comments similar to what Elizabeth is talking about. We also need to be very careful that even though we may feel that way, we need to wait and let the science develop. Could there be some intolerance to products we're using in preserving our foods or the farming methods or the chemicals? Yes. But once again, I think it's important to identify these and see how best we can relate to them. I don't think there's any doubt that there's been a significant change in the way farming is done now than what it was 50, 100 years ago. And clearly, some of these people without celiac but who don't tolerate wheat-based products may be reacting to something in the wheat, not necessarily the same as people with celiac.
So this would be – and the fact that the disease goes back how many years?
Several centuries, actually.
So that would predate modern farming methods.
That's right. And so the disease itself is hard to justify that way. But those who are intolerant to wheat-based products, are they reacting to something else apart from the wheat? Maybe. And to emphasize what Amy mentioned, the general consensus is that we're seeing a signal, but we need a lot more to be done before we define this entity, the gluten sensitivity that we're talking about.
Let's take another call from Julie in Mount Lebanon. Julie, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Hi. Yeah, this is Julia Greer. I'm actually in the GI division at UPMC, University of Pittsburgh School of Medicine. And I know Kofi.
Hi.
Hi. So I just had a quick question because a lot of people ask me, because I'm sort of big into nutrition and teach nutrition and medicine, they ask me, that is going on a gluten-free diet a good way to cleanse or get rid of toxins? And I personally think when you go gluten-free, you're eating a lot more corn, and you're really getting rid of a lot of the fiber in your diet.
Well, Julie, let me run a quote by you from Dr. William Davis. He's a cardiologist and author of the book Wheat Belly, and he says that eating processed gluten-free foods over time can lead to disorders such as diabetes, hypertension, and heart disease. So I think Dr. Clark, with the processed gluten-free foods as opposed to those that don't have the processed ingredients?
So I think we're having different discussions. What Julie is alluding to is some of the comments that have been observed in the past about eating gluten-free foods. And what the gentleman you mentioned to is his observation and some of the work he's done. Once again, it is important to stress that the science should develop. I'll give you a couple of quick examples. So, for instance, it's not unusual to see people who are diagnosed with celiac disease suddenly beginning to gain weight when they go on a gluten-free diet. There are a couple of theories. One is that they find a particular type of food they can tolerate now. They absorb better because the villi has now regenerated, and they continue to eat those amounts of maybe calorie-dense products, and then they gain the weight. Now, going to the example which this cardiologist is talking about, until now, and I mean just a few months ago, the FDA has no direction on what you can put in a gluten-free label and say this is gluten-free foods that I'm selling. So you do have a few people or manufacturers who were marketing things out there where maybe we're not entirely sure where the details of the ingredients are coming from. That's what Amy stresses to people when we worked together, reading the label. And please, let's be careful in saying that when we call something gluten-free, are we actually looking at the label or what the or who is marketing it is telling us in there? So there are some signals that we're seeing. Once again, we need to be very careful in trying to put that across as science or fact yet. And I think we'll learn a lot as we go along.
Amy, in your opinion, should even people who don't have gluten sensitivity avoid wheat products?
No. As prior to myself living the gluten-free lifestyle, wheat in the form of whole wheat, your whole wheat bread, your whole wheat pastas are very healthy, and it's a great way to add B vitamins, fiber, and iron into our diets, which can lack that. So I always promote whole wheat products to people that do not have celiac disease or any intolerance to gluten.
Why do you suppose there's this sudden strong interest in gluten-free products, even among people who don't have celiac disease?
I think a couple years ago, a few celebrities have gone gluten-free, so they have advertise that in some way where, how'd you lose all that weight? Oh, I went gluten-free. And to build upon what Dr. Clark said, a gluten-free diet, if you're focusing on naturally gluten-free foods, so you're eating your fresh vegetables, your fresh fruits, your lean, unprocessed meats, fish, poultry, and non-fat, low-fat dairy products, that's the way we were meant to eat. You are going to consume less calories and you're going to be healthier. But if you're going gluten-free and you're switching out your breads, your pastas, any sweet treats that you want, the gluten-free products typically have more calories because more fat and sugar are added for the palatability of the products. So to if you're the naturally gluten-free foods, yes, very healthy. You can live a very healthy life. But
if it's processed.
Yes. There's no nutritional value there because a lot of those products are made with refined flours and starches. They're not whole grains that are being produced in those products.
Let's go back to our callers. We have Jim in Pittsburgh. Has been on a gluten-free diet for 15 years, it says. Jim, welcome.
Good afternoon. Thank you for taking my call. Yes, I've been gluten-free for 15 years. I was gluten-free before gluten-free was really cool. And I'm quite vigilant. I'm very disciplined. Everyone in the family knows my dietary restrictions. At deer camp, everybody knows. But, you know, when I get my blood drawn, I test positive for the antigen, and I just am floored when I get that result, being as disciplined as I am. I was just wondering, what foods would you say the gluten is hidden in and is the most common way that a gluten would get into a gluten-free diet?
I'll take that call, mean that question from you. There are a lot of hidden sources, what people call hidden sources. So, for instance, canned chicken broth, soy sauce, these are products that have wheat, usually wheat in them, but it's gluten that people don't even think of. But do you eat out often?
Jim, are you still there? Oh, we lost Jim.
Okay, so I'll just go more on that part. So
let's assume that he does.
So if he eats out a lot, I always say it's easy to switch the food out when you're in these restaurants, but the kitchen really needs to understand that you're gluten-free because your meal could get contaminated in the back, whether it's a shared salad bowl, tossing a Caesar salad that has the crouton crumbs in it. There's some may for soups are thickened with wheat flour, or they can have chicken base in them or beef base that may have the wheat in there. So it could come in that way. Another thing is some contamination in gluten-free flours are being seen. So I always recommend if people bake a lot of gluten-free products to make sure they get a certified gluten-free flour because they're seeing some contamination, and the same was seen in oats. Oats were once removed from the gluten-free diet because it used to be thought that oats were an offending grain for those that had celiac disease, but it isn't the grain itself. It's the contamination from the crop rotation, the harvesting and sharing of the equipment and the packaging equipment that the oats get highly contaminated with wheat, rye, and barley. So they're just some areas where people can ingest gluten and really not know that they're getting it.
And if Jim is not someone who eats out a lot, then it could simply be coming from ingredients in foods that he's eating, particularly processed foods that he may not be aware of.
Yes. Or if you're buying in bulk bins and there's any sharing of the scoops, there could be contamination there. Some bulk spices, if things are being imported, you really need to know where your product's coming from and what those processes are in those companies to keep food safe.
Let's take a call from Chris in Pittsburgh. Chris, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call.
Yes.
Just a brief note. I work at a brewery, and I wanted to, you know, make a distinction about malt and barley. Malt is essentially a barley product. It's a syrup that you make by boiling barley, and it's in all beer. It's also in all scotch, so your caller should probably avoid those as well, but should be just fine with pretty much any wine, and potato vodkas are always gluten-free.
So are distilled alcohols. Even though even though a product may start out with, like, say, rye scotch, or if even though they're using offending grain in the beginning, the gluten is a large molecule. The distillation process renders it gluten-free because the gluten molecule can't get in the final distillate. So as long as the alcohol is distilled, it is safe on a gluten-free diet.
Drinking wheat-based vodkas and scotches.
Well, yes.
Chris, aren't there gluten-free beers?
Yes.
There are, but they're typically made from grains like spelt. You know, it's not exactly German beer purity law.
Well, spelt is not gluten-free. That's a form of wheat. So I hope gluten-free beers aren't made with spelt. I don't really understand the beer brewing process, but if it's made from spelt, that wouldn't be gluten-free.
All right. Thank you, Chris. Let's take one more call from Karen from Pittsburgh. Karen, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh. Hi, Karen. Are you there?
Oh, yes. I'm here. Thank you.
Go ahead with your comment or question for Dr. Kofi Clark or Amy Macklin.
Okay, thanks. So I have my 2-year-old daughter on a gluten-free diet, and one of my concerns is that I've heard a lot of talk recently about the levels of arsenic in rice products. So I just wondered what your thoughts were on that, especially with her being so young, if that, there could be a risk in giving her more rice products.
Dr. Clark is smiling and shaking his head. Go ahead, Dr. Clark.
I think something to think about is, before we get concerned about these obviously chemical products that could be potentially harmful, we need to be very careful where the sources of this information is coming from. I mean, clearly, a cumulative dose of arsenic could be significantly toxic or sometimes even lethal. I also don't think that unless somebody is making these products illegally, that arsenic in any significant quantities will be allowed to get onto the market. Keep in mind, it's a very well-controlled, dangerous chemical if it's not used in the right setting. So once again, being careful where you're getting your products from the standard sources, reading the labels is the way to go. But I haven't seen any good signs out there telling us that if we feed people diets with significant amounts of rice, they will get into trouble down the line from arsenic toxicity. Think of it in a different way as well. There are certain parts of the world where we have people whose diets are predominantly rice-based, and we don't seem to see a spike in those individuals from toxicities from arsenic.
Hopefully that puts your mind at ease, Karen. And thank you for that phone call. We have been talking with Dr. Kofi Clark, a gastroenterologist and director of the Celiac Center at Allegheny General Hospital, and Amy Macklin, a registered dietitian, nutritionist, and owner of Gluten-Free Roots, a Robinson-based consulting business. Thank you both for joining us for this interesting discussion. We appreciate it.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you for having us.
Coming up, Bob Dvorak reviews the top sports stories of the year and why Steelers fans are the most depressed after a loss. It's Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA.